C7. Number 14B.
Or she says, by reversal, error serves as waymarks to the one mind, in which all error disappears in celestial truth. So again, apparently what seems to be error can be changed into truth, can disappear. Actually, not error can change into truth, but error disappears, and in its place, truth appears, and it's just a question of how we look at it, if we reverse our standpoint or not. Actually, in the Bible, this has been taught long ago, and if you take perhaps one of the most illustrative incidents was Moses with his staff, and the staff was turned into a serpent, and the serpent again back into a staff. So what is real? Is the staff real or is the serpent real? It all depended on his mental attitude, and according to his subjective attitude, a serpent was either a serpent or a rod. So it can be both. And so in that way, one begins to see today that it is no more so that the thing is a thing, and that thing remains a thing as what it is, and that thing is a thing and has identity. No, today a thing can be a thing, but it also can be another thing. The subjective approach changes the universe. Eternal truth changes the universe. And naturally, in the measure that we approach, therefore, the universe from an infinite standpoint, and at that moment we have an infinite universe. If we approach the universe from a limited sense, we have a limited universe. So that whole chapter on creation gives a terrific sense of trying to expand our consciousness and try to free ourselves from the limitations of thinking, to the point of being absolutely free from any limitation, which means it is actually showing that we should free ourselves from the limitation of thinking to the point of the infinite idea. Thinking, as we know, is always limited. Thinking has to do with our brain, and thinking has to do that thoughts come and go, that they have a beginning and an end, that thoughts change, that they take on different qualities of good and evil. So thoughts are very unreliable as a means of looking at reality. Therefore, what we have to do is to look at reality not through thoughts, but through ideas. Ideas is that wonderful thing that is above or beyond the concept of time and space. It's that wonderful thing that is beyond a concept of good and evil. We can never say that 2 and 2 equal 4 is good. We can't say that this is good. It is. It is beyond good and evil, because we know that if we have 2 million debts and 2 million debts, that makes 4 million debts, and we wouldn't think that is very good. It's always a question that we attribute to something a quality of good and evil, but the thing itself is beyond the evaluation of good and evil. So ideas are actually beyond good and evil. Therefore, actually we should never speak about a good idea, because there are not bad ideas. We should never really speak about a right idea, because there is never a wrong idea. We do it sometimes just because we are used in this way, but scientifically it is not really right. Idea is beyond good and evil, is beyond right and wrong. Idea is beyond time and space. It's a wonderful measurement, an infinite measurement. So if we can measure up anything according to ideas, we really measure up something always according to infinitude. And that is a freeing concept. And you can see why perhaps today the physicists who are looking out for the ultimate building blocks of reality, the ultimate smallest particle and quantum of what constitutes reality, that they more and more are pushed away out of the realm of space and time towards conceptual building blocks, where they say reality consists of relationship and not of quantums, not of particles, not of electrons and things like that, but that reality consists of relationships and pushed into the field that is much more metaphysical than physical. And Heisenberg, for instance, as one of the outstanding modern physicists, he was seeing that things have to do with ideas. He even could see that an idea is nothing else but a structure, and that therefore idea is the answer to matter. He began to see that idea is the answer to matter. Idea and answer to matter. Who has said that before? Mrs. Eddy. Her whole chapter on creation and then afterwards on science of being teaches that idea is the answer to a material universe. Here in this chapter it is showing that very, very clearly. It is as if she would ask us in this chapter to expand in consciousness so that we lose the limiting factors of thinking and are in the realm of the unlimited idea. She says right at the beginning, I just read a few quotations. It's usually not very agreeable to listen to quotation, but I just give you a few. Just listen not so much to what the sentence says, but to the tonality of that expansion from finiteness into infinitude. She says, as mortals drop off their mental swaddling clothes. Can you see that mental and swaddling clothes that are so tight, so narrow, so narrow, and thought is caged in. Thought expands into expression. Advancing to a higher plane of action, thought rises. Again, thought rises from the material sense to the spiritual, from the scholastic to the inspirational, from the mortal to the immortal. Finiteness cannot present the idea of the vastness of infinity. Creation is therefore the infinite image or idea emanating from mind. Can you see? Now, thought expands and expands and expands into the vastness until we finally see that creation is the image of the infinite idea emanating from mind. God expresses in men the infinite idea, forever developing itself, broadening and rising higher and higher from a boundless basis. Even the basis is boundless, and within that infinite, unlimited basis, there is still a sense of rising higher, broadening out, apparently we have to find a completely new model of thinking that we can think of a boundless basis, of a boundless, of an infinite basis, and still have a rising higher and higher, and still have a broadening and broadening. You see, this seems to be a paradox. This is a paradox until we drop the old classical sense that we have been trained in and have grown up, that broadening and rising higher and higher, that rising higher has to do something with space, with a height, instead of seeing that rising higher and higher can also be something that is independent of space and time, namely that it has to do with restructuring the infinite factors involved in a subject. that is another kind of rising higher and broadening and widening out. Yeah, well, I think these are a few statements that give us a sense of this infinitude. The scriptural note here, the first one from Psalms, says, "Thy throne is established of old." Is established of old. Well, that's naturally a biblical expression, and we still have to think back. The Psalms have perhaps been written, I don't know, 500 B.C., in a time when they certainly didn't have a very abstract world view, where they still had a mystical worldview, where they still had to use a very limited vocabulary, and therefore one must see that what they expressed in their words is not what they would express today in the same words. It was indicating what afterwards is said, "Thou art from everlasting." I think they just wanted to bring out that the principle, thy throne, the principle of being, is of the nature of isness. And the isness they could only bring out by a very long time concept, from everlasting. So that the creation is established as isness, not as something that has to be brought into being through a creative process. And therefore, the moment we have a sense of isness, and this is always the big point, we have to think in terms of spaceless and timeless concept. 2 and 2 = 4 don't take up any space and don't take up any time. And this is really the big point. The moment we speak about is and isness, it's that realm which is unknown to the classical way of thinking. We are born into a world where we order everything in a framework of time and space. Everything happens somewhere and sometime. Whereas isness is that new structure of consciousness which only calculates with infinite, with unlimited ideas, with unlimited factors. And this is a completely new education that we have to go through. And that is perhaps that point where the mystics are trained much better. They are trained much more to think in terms of isness than in terms of space and time. So here we have to see, we have to re-educate ourselves. Eternal truth changes the universe. Eternal truth. Why on earth would she call eternal truth? It's a rendering that she uses practically. I'm not now sure. I haven't looked it up right now. But eternal truth is a combination. I don't think she uses it very often, if at all, except here. And means, why eternal truth, you see? Because that whole thy throne is established of old, you see, thou art from everlasting, wants to indicate that when we look out from truth as a timeless, spaceless concept, that then we will have a universe that is completely different than our time-space universe. So, can you see what we have to be aware of when we read the textbook? You see, interpretation is everything. A student may read, "Eternal truth changes the universe," and he says, "That's, I believe that, I can see that. That truth does change something." And the student has a sense, yes, this universe is really a universe where so much happens that is discordant, that is erroneous, that is false. You see, he has a sense of a disharmonious universe. So he said, "Oh, wonderful, you know, truth will change that. Truth will just put that universe into a sense of harmony, into a sense of a universe where there is health instead of sickness, where there is no accident, where there is abundance instead of lack. Can you see what he's thinking? He's not thinking that eternal truth is changing the universe. He's thinking truth is changing the universe. He has afterwards the same old kind of limited universe, only that it is not erroneous, that it is healthier and more harmonious. But what Mrs. Eddy wants to show in this chapter is not that. She wants to show that eternal truth is changing the universe, which means that the outcome of eternal universe will be a universe of isness. Of isness. Of a timeless, a spaceless universe. And not just a universe which just doesn't have sin, sickness and death and all that, etc., which she usually takes up as erroneous phenomena. See, in that chapter here on creation, she hardly deals with sickness, sin and death and these inharmonious phenomena. What she deals with is that a limited universe must be changed in a completely infinite universe. And that is a completely different proposition. Can you see that? See? So if we can listen to what she actually says and interpret rightly, not to put our interpretation in, the whole textbook yields its riches, yields really its teaching. Did I make that point clear about? So what she wants to show is something quite terrific, that eternal truth is changing a limited sense of the universe into an isness universe, into a universe of infinitude, a universe of infinite ideas, a universe that consists only of the isness of ideas, and that's what you want to bring out. Yeah? Okay. Now, she has a second scriptural note that now shows actually how that first scriptural note is translated down to a lower level, to the level of Christian Science, as the first one is on the level of divine science as the isness universe. And she says in the second scriptural note, "For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now." Can you hear at once a different level? The level of groaning, it's the level of Christian Science. And then it goes on and says, "And not only they, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of spirit, which have it. Even we ourselves groan." Why should we groan if we have it? Seems to be a paradox. If we have the first fruit of spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our body. Can you see what she says? She brings down the divine science to absolute Christian science to the fact we have the first fruit of spirit. But then she translates it down to the level of Christian science and says, but humanly we still groan to wit the redemption of our body. Actually, you have all three levels in here. Showing what? Showing really what is very practical in our life, namely, we know that fundamentally we are the sons of God. That we know. That's the first fruit of spirit. That we know that fundamentally we are the sons of God. And then she translates it to the point of Christian Science, but says, but we have to make ourselves the son of God. Though we are it, we have to make ourselves the Son of God. That's then you take in all three levels, and that is then practical, because then you don't leave out any level of consciousness, which says, yes, we know fundamentally that we have the first fruit of spirit, we know fundamentally that we are the sons of God, but we have to go and demonstrate it, we have to go and prove it, we have to go and adopt it, so that we can, with the adoption, that we are the Son of God, and the redemption of our body. So, here we have a wonderful example of the translatability within those levels of science. How are we going to make ourselves the Son of God? Well, by taking off our limits. If we take off our limits and take off our swaddling clothes, as said at the beginning of the chapter, and take off our swaddling clothes, take off the sense that we live in a universe of thoughts that is determined by limited thoughts, if we do that, then we take off the limits, and that's what Mrs. Eddy wants to show through the chapter, and end up with the ropes of spirit, which are white and glistering. That's the end of the chapter. Can you see? It is taking off the limited viewpoint until finally we have the ropes of spirit, white, a symbol for all the seven synonymous terms. Therefore, close ourselves with the seven synonymous terms, and we are closed with the ropes of spirit. That was the first fruit of spirit, with the ropes of spirit, and that is white and glistering. So we make ourselves the Son of God by identifying ourselves only with the unlimited ideas, instead of identifying ourselves with our thinking. Therefore, we are not what we think. You see, Mrs. Eddy uses that statement from the Bible a few times in the textbook, where she says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Well, that's true and that's wrong, both. It's true on the level of Christian Science. As a man thinketh, so is he. If I think always negatively, then what I experience is a negative life. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. But that is not true from the point of view of science. From the point of view of science, man is not what he thinketh. From the point of view of science, he is the idea of mind and not what he thinketh. And so you can see, one has to be careful with these quotations and interpret them rightly and put them into the right level. And Mrs. Eddy is quite careful sometimes. She says, as a man thinketh in his heart, and puts in brackets, understands, so is he. At one point, in one of the quotations, she puts in brackets, understands, instead of thinks, so is he. Indicating the moment we put it into the realm of mind, then as a man understands mind, so is man. But without that, it's just a metaphysical proposition, which is also true, but which is not Christian Science. It's metaphysics. And so here too we have the first fruits of spirit, but we may still, in the human, groan within ourselves, because we have not yet made the idea of mind our own identity. But this is really what she asked, to take off the limits, take off the limits, take off the limits, take off the limits especially of thinking. Get out of thinking, or as she says, get out of thinking. Go into the realm of idea. Take off the limits of thinking. See that everything, creation, is of the nature of idea, and idea are always infinite. Not one single idea is finite. Not one single idea has a place in time or space. Oh, it's so wonderful to think about ideas not having time, not having space limits. You think about it quietly. You will feel the bigness, the broadness, the wideness, the height, the depth, the majesty that comes up when you think, oh, ideas are really the building blocks of reality. Ideas. Where are they? They are nowhere. When do they appear? They never appear. They are in another realm, in the realm of ideas, of a completely timeless, spaceless universe. Just think about 2 and 2 = 4. It's a truth, a wonderful truth. It's not bound to time and space. And in this way, I think we can free ourselves from the limitation and come into the oneness of the universe, the unlimited universe. It's a terrific universe. All right, we make a break here.